really was. But at other times, when she chose June to confide in or spirited her away on an adventure, it felt wonderful. Everyone looked at them because Cece was beautiful. Everyone, the other girls and all the boys, wanted to be at their table because Cece automatically gave it an air of glamour and elegance. In those moments, June felt so special. She'd look over at Cece, and Cece would wink back, and the world would know they were best friends. Chapter 5. Charlie and Anne had been offered a two-bedroom house just 1 month after adding Sam to their application. It was perched on the side of a hill covered with identical structures. Each resembled a small child's drawing of a house, a plain white rectangle with a slanted roof. The only accessory was a small porch just big enough for a bench, which jutted out beside the doorway. Besides one tree that had been spared by the construction crew, the yard consisted entirely of mud. Charlie had carried Anne over the threshold even as she yelled at him, "I have my boots on, I can walk through a little mud," laughing all the while. Sam had volunteered to help them move. His own possessions were easily hauled over from the dorm in one trip. When Charlie let her down in their new living room, Anne sighed. "How will I ever keep these floors clean?"
"We can leave our boots by the door," suggested Sam.
"Somehow it doesn't work," replied Anne. "We tried everything in the trailer. Sometimes I think the mud actually has a mind of its own and crawls into the house." Anne was thin, with sharp features that could look severe when her expression was serious. But when she smiled, which luckily was often, her features relaxed and her face became welcoming.
"Oh, it's cold in here," said Charlie. "Better go take a look at the furnace."
"I'll do it," volunteered Sam. "You finish up with the moving."
Sam went past the utility room, which housed a coal furnace, and out a back door to the coal box. He opened it, began loading coal into a small bucket, then hauled it inside to the furnace. It was wonderful to be out of the dorm. Every day he got new roommates, and they had gotten progressively worse. Last night, two of them stayed up until 2, playing cards, while the third snored at an inconceivable volume. As if that weren't enough, his room was flooded with light at night because of the construction going on down the road. On his way to the bus stop in the morning, Sam would see the shells of new buildings that had literally gone up overnight. Anne stuck her head in the utility room. "I hope you can eat supper with us tonight, Sam. I think we should have a celebration."
"Sounds great, Anne."
She flitted off, looking far too delicate in her white satin blouse for this dirty town. Sam slapped his hands together to knock off the coal dust and looked around. Charlie and Anne had managed to bring some nice things with them that made the house look livable. Charlie was hanging up framed prints of flowers in the living room while Anne arranged a lace tablecloth on the dining table. Their efforts at decorating were endearing, though completely foreign to Sam, who had never bothered to do a thing to his apartment in Berkeley during his years of living there. He went down the hall to his room. It was small but comfortable, furnished with a simple dresser, table, and bed. He unpacked easily, flopped back on the bed, and stared up at the ceiling, beginning to relax for what seemed like the first time since he'd arrived in Oak Ridge. On the first day of his new job, Sam had spent 10 minutes wandering through a sprawling parking lot, buses snaking in and out, before he found the sign for Y-12, the facility where he would be working. A distressing number of people were already waiting. Bus service in Oak Ridge was free, but everyone had to show their badge as they got on to prove they were allowed into the Y-12 area. Sam stood in the midsection of the bus as he watched the Negroes make their way past the sign that read colored. This was his first time in the South, and though he hadn't exactly spent his youth palling around with the locals in Harlem, the explicitness of segregation here startled him. Charlie had told him that there was a whole other section of housing that hadn't been on his official army tour, where the colored construction workers lived in tiny shacks. Sam looked out the window at a train carrying an endless line of identical trailers. It was starting to rain. The bus wound through the security checkpoint, and he finally saw Y-12, a series of large, warehouse-looking buildings. The plant was designed to enrich uranium. For the weapon the Army was trying to make, the uranium isotope U-235 was required and needed to be separated from U-238. The top physicists in America had spent the past few years trying to figure out the best way to do this. At Berkeley, Ernest Lawrence had designed the Calutron, which used magnets to get the job done, and this was the method employed at Y-12. Sam had worked with him, experimenting and designing the prototype for what would now be used on a massive scale here in Oak Ridge. He could hardly keep from running straight into the plant. He was so excited to see what they'd been working on for so long. Once he made it through security, Sam reported to his new supervisor, Dr. Armstrong, a stocky man of about 40, who gave Sam's hand an aggressive shake and led him down a long corridor.
"It's good to have you here, Dr. Cantor. As you can see, the facilities are operational, but we're having a lot of difficulties."
He opened the door to his office for Sam and closed it behind them.
"Please, sit down. In a nutshell, we've been asked to achieve the impossible here. We've built an enormous facility without knowing how it's going to operate, and so far it's been little short of disastrous. You've been briefed on the plant's operations?"
He had. The day before, a thick envelope marked Top Secret had been hand-delivered to him, which included a blueprint of the entire Y-12 facility and outlined its operations.
"We're adjacent to the Alpha-1 building now," continued Dr. Armstrong. "Would you like to take a look at the racetrack?"
"Yes, sir."
"You might want to leave your watch here. The magnets can destroy it. And if you have any other metal on you..."
"I don't think I do."
Sam laid his watch on the desk. The uranium began the enrichment process in the Alpha buildings, which were referred to as racetracks because of their ovular shape. This racetrack contained 96 calutrons. In the calutron, a vaporized sample of uranium was bombarded with electrons and became ionized. Next, the ions were injected into a vacuum chamber, accelerated, and sent through a strong magnetic field, which forced them into radial paths. The lighter U-235 traveled on a smaller radius than the heavier U-238, and in this way, the isotopes could be separated. Dr. Armstrong took Sam into a nearby building, which looked like a typical factory from the outside. After passing through two more security checkpoints, they went into the production area, and Sam got his first look at the racetrack. The calutrons were arranged around a powerful electromagnet in an oval for maximum efficiency. The oval was about 40 yards long and 25 yards across.
"Come on, I'll take you for a closer look."
Dr. Armstrong led him to one of the calutron inspection windows. Behind heavy glass, Sam saw it. The strange blue glow that he knew to be uranium. It was beautiful. Next, Dr. Armstrong led him up a staircase to the catwalk above the racetrack. Large steel beams rose above them. Stepping onto the catwalk, Sam felt a tugging at his feet like he was walking through chewing gum. Dr. Armstrong saw his look of alarm and shouted, "The nails in your shoes are being pulled by the magnets." He could look down on the calutrons now, though there wasn't much to see. It was what was going on inside them that was miraculous. When they descended, Dr. Armstrong took him out to the operating cubicles, a long hallway filled with control panels where young women sat on stools, carefully monitoring the dials. At Berkeley, graduate students had been in charge of operating the calutrons. These girls looked like they belonged in the halls of a high school, rather than at the center of the world's most sophisticated scientific operation. They ignored Sam and Dr. Armstrong and stayed focused on the controls. As they walked back to Dr. Armstrong's office, the older man seemed to perceive Sam's thoughts.
"We need manpower to run the facility, but obviously there aren't any men around, so we have 18-year-old girls out there operating these things."
"Do they have any inkling of what they're dealing with?"
"Of course not. Even if we wanted to explain it to them, do you think these girls would understand? Most of them come from local communities and have no more than a high school education, which is substandard at that. So we tell them to watch the meter and adjust the dials to keep them in the right spot. They do as they're told. We haven't had any problems yet, except with the occasional girl crying when the magnets pull her hairpins out."
They arrived back at Dr. Armstrong's office, and he ushered Sam inside.
"Let me tell you, Dr. Cantor, these girls aren't the least of our problems. Building the facilities has been a challenge every step of the way. The amount of money already spent here is staggering. Have you wondered, for instance, how we ever got enough copper to produce the electromagnets?"
"How?"
"We didn't. Instead of copper, we've used silver. 14,000 tons of it borrowed from the U.S. Treasury."
"My God. I cannot stress to you enough how high the stakes are here. The government has invested a monumental sum of money and manpower in this project. And as I'm sure you know, we have every reason to think that Hitler has done the same."
Dr. Armstrong had worked himself up. His blue eyes glistened, and Sam could hardly stand to hold his stare.
"I'm ready to help in any way I can.
Good. We're losing far too much material, and what we're producing isn't enriched enough. The racetracks are in constant peril of breaking down. We've already had vacuum tanks leaking. Mistakes have been made at all levels of operations. Electrical circuits have shorted, and welds have failed. I'm afraid you have climbed aboard a sinking ship, but I hope we can bail ourselves out yet. These sorts of problems had to be expected with a project of this scale.
Dr. Armstrong gave him a bemused half-smile.
As far as the Army is concerned, problems are never expected. Now, I know you're probably disappointed about not being down in New Mexico with the big shots designing the weapon, but let me assure you that Y-12 needs a physicist like yourself with experience in the rad lab. If we don't sort things out here, our boys in Los Alamos won't have anything to make their bomb out of. We have a research wing in this building, and I am putting you in charge of the laboratory there. I promise you, Dr. Cantor, the next few months are going to be very busy.
Sam felt like a soldier with a mission. To be given a research project of this scope was thrilling. What did it matter if he was living in a dorm as long as he had a laboratory? He would essentially live in the lab anyway, and he wanted to start this minute. He had the wonderful certainty that he was doing the very thing that he was born to do. The conviction stayed with him throughout his busy first day. It kept him happy and focused as he went about his work, sure of himself and what he was doing. It wasn't until late that night in his dorm room that he began to doubt. He lay in bed, unable to sleep. Images of softly glowing uranium plasma danced in his head as he contemplated what building this bomb would mean. It was by no means the first time he had thought about it, but it also had never seemed so real as it did today, standing face to face with one of the most expensive government projects in history, all aimed at gathering a handful of uranium isotopes. Dr. Armstrong worried that Y-12 would never be functional, but Sam didn't doubt for a minute the project would succeed. There was a certain momentum to something this big. With this many minds, this much effort, a bomb was inevitable. Sam had fallen asleep without meaning to in the peaceful quiet of his new room at Anne and Charlie's house. He was awakened by the sound of Anne screaming, "It's loose! Charlie, do something!" Sam felt around the unfamiliar nightstand for his glasses and leapt off the bed, heading toward the living room. He stopped abruptly in the hallway when he saw a live chicken hopping and flapping around the living room. Anne was squealing by the front door while Charlie stalked the bird from behind. "Sam," called out Anne, "do you know how to kill a chicken?"
"I'm from Brooklyn," was all he could manage.
Charlie lunged forward and grabbed the bird by a wing. It made a terrible squawk, and he grabbed its leg.
"Get a knife, Sam," he commanded, "and meet me out back."
Sam opened the kitchen drawers in search of a knife, still groggy from his nap. He saw steak knives, butter knives, nothing really appropriate for killing a chicken.
"Here," Anne called out. "We haven't unpacked it yet."
She appeared in the kitchen, holding out a butcher knife for Sam. Dutifully, he took it and went out back. Charlie was standing by the coal box, holding the chicken as far out in front of himself as possible. He gave Sam a desperate look.
"I think we chop its head off." "Why do we have a live chicken, Charlie?"
"Apparently that's all they had at the market. Anne wanted dinner to be special, and she somehow managed to carry this thing all the way home. Then it got loose, and, well, you know the rest."
They stared at the mass of feathers and flesh.
Sam wished he'd ignored the shouting and stayed in his room.
"Why don't you hold it down on the ground?" he ventured. "All right."
Charlie bent his long legs and hunched over to place the chicken on the ground. Sam stood over it with the knife, took a deep breath, and whacked at the creature's neck. A spray of blood spurted up into his face.
"God damn it!"
Sam wiped his face with his hands. Charlie was still holding the now headless creature down as it lurched and kicked out its final moments.
"What do we do now?"
I guess we have to get rid of the feathers."
"Jesus Christ."
When they got the bird to a state they hoped would no longer horrify Anne, Sam went to the bathroom to scrub off the blood and feathers. He never wanted to see a chicken again. Nevertheless, after a couple of hours, a delicious smell began to waft from the kitchen. Sam helped set the table, and he and Charlie sat across from each other until Anne brought it out, placing it proudly in the middle of the table, a lovely hump of bronzed, dripping meat. There were carrots and mashed potatoes, too, all served on elegant plates.
"It looks marvelous,"
said Sam.
Certainly better than when we left it, said Charlie. He stood and dug the same knife he had used earlier to dispatch the bird into its roasted flesh.
Well, said Anne, this is real country living after all, I suppose.
I can't believe you made it home with this thing, Charlie spoke with affection.
I was determined to have chicken, and when I asked the man at the store for one, he went to the back and brought it out. At first I panicked, but then I realized lots of people must kill chickens every day for dinner.
Charlie sat back down and raised his water glass.
A toast! To our new house!
They clanked glasses. Sam dug his knife and fork into the meat. It was delicious.
It's good to have a home-cooked meal.
Poor Sam, said Charlie, pointing at him with his knife. Needs a woman to look after him. There had been a woman in California, off and on, a secretary at the university, who had been conveniently married to an accountant Sam had never met. He didn't have to worry about marrying her, or making her think he wanted to marry her, or any of that. Bored with her accountant husband, she had pursued Sam, another handy aspect of their relationship since he had never been particularly adept at wooing women. Back in college, she had passionately chased after one girl for almost 2 years, but her unrelenting rejection had dampened his romantic spirit. There had been dates and a couple of minor courtships in graduate school, but they had been achieved only with great discomfort. It all ended badly.
I'm afraid that's too great a task for any woman,
Sam replied. Anne's brow furrowed.
Nonsense. I'm sure you'd make someone a lovely mate. And this is the perfect place to look. They say when the facilities are all up and running, we'll have 8 women to every 1 man here at Oak Ridge.
What, you think I should marry one of these local girls?
There are girls from all over, replied Anne. Secretaries, teachers, I've even met a chemist.
Anne is vice president of the Oak Ridge Women's Club, explained Charlie, and she sings in a choir.
I had no idea we had clubs and choirs in Oak Ridge.
Well, we're only just getting going, of course, but you'd be surprised at what goes on. There's a real thirst for community involvement, maybe since the community's so new.
Take a look at the Oak Ridge Journal, Sam. You get a real laugh from the list of organizations. There's a folk dancing group, a rabbit breeders association. What do you think? Ready to take up an extracurricular activity?
I've got plenty to keep me occupied at work.
Oh, come on, Sam, said Anne. You can't work all the time.
Well, no, said Charlie. He came pretty close at Princeton.
I'm just doing my part for the war effort,
said Sam.
Charlie hooted.
Sam Cantor, patriot. I like it. After dinner, they drank tea in the living room and listened to the news on the radio, mostly reports of the Allied bombing of Berlin. When Anne retired to her bedroom, Charlie took Sam's teacup from him, placed it on a shelf, and asked,
Shall we continue celebrating?
What did you have in mind?
Charlie opened a trunk below the shelf, dug through it, and pulled out a bottle of Johnny Walker. Sam sat up, astounded.
You rascal! How did you get it here?
I smuggled it in. I've only had the nerve to with this one bottle, and look, I've drunk hardly any of it after getting it in. Charlie poured a slug into each of their empty teacups and replaced the bottle in the trunk. I rolled it up in the middle of Anne's undergarments, hoping that would dissuade security from taking too close a look. Sam sniffed the whiskey appreciatively, letting it tickle his nose for a long moment.
I didn't know you had it in you, Charlie.
To the future. Charlie held out his glass. Sam raised an eyebrow.
The future.
He took a long sip and felt the sweet, familiar burn slide down his throat. Charlie went over to a record player and put down the needle. Big, brassy jazz suddenly filled the room. The sound perfectly matched the buzz in Sam's head. A trumpet wailed out, and he took a second sip. Charlie sat and leaned in toward him.
What do you think? Anne's a light sleeper, so I don't want to talk too loudly, but what do you think? Is this going to work?
What?
Asked Sam, completely absorbed in the music and his scotch.
This.
Charlie motioned around them with a sweep of his hands.
Can we do this thing?
Sam caught his drift.
You mean build a bomb?
I haven't said the word since I got here.
The security talks really get to you, don't they?
I mean, for all I know, you're an undercover security agent.
Please don't be ridiculous. For all we know, Anne is.
Yeah, I'm fairly certain we're working in different areas. I'm at X-10.
I'm at Y-12.
Perhaps it was the whiskey, but he actually felt his heart rate speed up a little. Charlie was right. The security talks did get to you. He'd been told so often not to talk about what he was doing that he felt nervous even here.
Let me guess, Sam said. You're working on a graphite reactor?
We just went critical. Sam sipped his whiskey. The graphite reactor was designed to turn uranium into a new element, plutonium, which could also be used in a bomb. The Army was trying more than one method to get what it needed. We're a pilot program, Charlie went on. There's a facility going up in Washington State just to produce plutonium. Sam drank a final gulp of whiskey.
Yes. To answer your question, Charlie, yeah. I think we will definitely do this thing. God forgive us.
I was afraid you'd say that. Charlie poured more drinks. They sat there for some time, silently, sipping their scotch, listening to the trumpet shriek and sputter. Chapter 6 Joe couldn't see Ralph anywhere in the rec hall, but he did find the boy's friend, Otis, leaning against a wall, smoking a cigarette. As best Joe could tell, Otis was always in the rec hall. He reckoned the young man must have worked sometime, but Joe never saw much evidence of it. As usual, Otis was immaculate, dressed like he was on his way to a nightclub. Shiny suit and tie, polished shoes, fedora tilted back on his head, carefully crafted mustache traversing his face. You'd think he was a gangster or a musician the way he presented himself, not a construction worker. Otis came from Memphis and had a citified walk and talk that left Joe feeling dizzy. He was always smiling, but not in a friendly way. More like he was laughing at you.
Evening, Joe. Otis sneered at him.
Evening.
Have you seen Ralph?
Yes, sir. He's with Shirley.
Otis's suggestive tone somehow made the girl's name sound indecent.
I see. They had one of them meetings?
Ralph had taken to attending the colored camp council.
No, sir. They're going for a walk.
He made the word walk sound even worse than Shirley.
What you make of Shirley?
Joe asked Otis. She was a girl from Atlanta Ralph had been chasing for months now. Otis shrugged.
She a fine-looking woman. Besides that, does there need to be a besides that?
You ain't going for them meetings, do you?
Only meetings I attend be about cards or dice.
Ralph gambling too?
Ain't you worry, preacher man.
He on the straight and narrow.
He grinned.
Despite all my best efforts.
Joe felt foolish for trying to talk to Otis, for thinking he cared about Ralph as anything more than an impressionable country boy he could impress with his Memphis swagger. He said a quick goodbye and went back out into the cold November night. Shirley had first come on the scene a few months ago. It had already been summertime hot, even though it was only the first week in June, and Joe and Ralph had started their shift in the thick heat of mid-afternoon. Their crew was digging trenches, laying pipes, and then digging some more, and after 5 minutes in the early summer sun, the men's shirts were dripping with sweat. Joe knew how to take his mind off the heat. He'd spent his life sharecropping in Alabama. The key was to find a thought or a song or Bible verse to focus the mind on, away from the discomfort, the aching back, the burning feet. Some men in the crew sang out loud, and that was a help. Joe couldn't carry a tune, but he liked to listen, and the music helped the time pass. The sun set, but the air stayed sultry. They were still digging into the night, the digging, pouring, lifting, building, none of it ever enough for the city in progress. An hour before the end of their shift, Joe heard a rumbling in the distance and felt a slight movement in the humid air. He knew the storm would cool them down, which was almost worth getting soaked for. Men hooted and hollered in the rain. The dirt became mud in a matter of minutes, and the foreman shook his head helplessly.
"Go on home," he shouted over the storm. "Shift is almost over, and it's no use getting anything done now."
Ralph began walking fast toward the bus stop.
"I'm starving,"
he muttered. Ralph still ate like a growing boy.
"Hopefully we'll miss the rush on the bus," Joe said.
A couple of white laborers were already waiting at the bus stop. Ralph, Joe, and three more men from their crew hung back from the white fellows. They couldn't have been any wetter, submerged in a bathtub. Joe kept his hand around the wad of money in his pocket to keep it as dry as possible. All the seats on the bus were full, but it wasn't bad compared to what they were used to at shift change. They often had to wait for two or three buses to go by before getting on. Of course, they had to let the white folks on first, and some bus drivers didn't even stop if they saw only Negroes waiting. The white men got on, and Joe and Ralph followed. The back of the bus was already filled with strap hangers, so they stood in the middle with the others from their crew. The bus lurched forward. Joe thought about what he would get for supper in the cafeteria. Beans and rice again, probably, which was fine with him as long as it was hot. A big crowd was waiting at the next stop. The shift must have ended. The bus driver, middle-aged, scrawny, with brown stubble on his face, stopped and turned back slowly to look at Joe and the other men from his crew. "You boys best get off and make room for these here passengers." Joe looked at Ralph, whose whole body tensed. "So we are passengers," the boy replied, calm, cool. The bus driver was chewing gum. "You colored boys best get off and make room for the white passengers. Get off the bus, niggers," a man shouted. Joe couldn't see who. He was already moving, dragging Ralph with him toward the door, following the other Negroes. Joe knew exactly what would come with trying to stay on that bus, and he feared Ralph didn't fully comprehend it. The boy had fought his stepfather, sure enough, but it seemed he didn't yet know that no luck could be depended on to save you in a struggle, especially when faced with 20 white men slicked with wet and hate. "I will report this to the army," Ralph shouted as Joe got him off the bus. The other Negro men shook their heads at him, and the whites in line watched them walk off with confusion. "Army don't give a shit, son," said one of the men from their crew, and Ralph kicked a Coke bottle hard as he could, the glass smashing loud enough to be heard over the pounding rain. They walked a mile in silence, rain pelting them the whole way to the cafeteria. Ralph stopped at the door.
"Ain't you coming in?" asked Joe.
Ralph shook his head.
"You need to eat."
"Ain't hungry."
Ralph turned and walked away. A couple of the other men from their crew laughed.
"I sure am."
"Let's get out of this rain," said another.
Joe held the door for them, still watching Ralph disappear into the storm. The rain had cleared up by the time Joe finished supper, but he was still sopping, his damp shirt clinging to his skin. He was desperate to go back to the hutment and change into dry clothes, but figured Ralph had gone to the rec center and wanted to check on the boy. He could hear voices and music spilling out of the center as he approached. Laughter, hoots, Billie Holiday crackling out of a speaker. The storm had gotten folks excited. Inside, it was hot. A feeble ceiling fan twirled above them, no contest for the 50-odd bodies mingling in the humid space. Most men sat at tables playing cards. A few took turns at the two punching bags in the corner. He found Ralph sitting at a table across from Otis. Smoke from their cigarettes billowed upward. Otis was laughing at some just-told joke, but Ralph didn't appear amused.
"Well, if you ain't as wet as Ralph here," said Otis, leaning back in his chair to make room for Joe to sit.
"Got caught out in a real frog strangler."
Ralph let out a short, angry laugh.
"Got throat out into it, you mean?"
Joe shrugged and reached in his shirt pocket for a cigarette.
"Welcome to the U.S. Army, son. At least we ain't getting shot at in Normandy. I'd just as soon not die for the privilege of getting thrown off a bus to serve my country."
Ralph's jaw twitched.
"Anyone want a Coca-Cola?" asked Joe.
Otis smiled as though he'd told a joke.
"Sure, Joe."
What did that grin mean? Joe had a mind to slap it right off Otis's face. When he returned with the Cokes, Joe slammed Otis's down in front of him hard, though he didn't seem to notice, taking a big swig from the bottle. Otis then pulled a glass bottle out of his pocket, winked at Joe, and poured a clear liquid into the soda.
"Want a little taste?"
Joe shook his head, and Otis's taunting grin returned.
"I forgot. You're a good church-going man."
"Ralph?"
Otis motioned toward the liquor.
"No thanks,"
said Ralph. Otis shrugged and took a long sip.
"I feel like dancing."
Duke Ellington blared from the jukebox, but no one was moving.
"What do you think of them ladies over there?"
he continued.
Reckon they'd like to dance?
Both Ralph and Joe looked over. They were the only women in the room of rough characters. About 8 nice-looking girls sitting around a table, sipping on Cokes. One of the girls noticed the 3 men staring at them and raised an eyebrow at Otis. She turned back to the others, and they all laughed. Otis let out a low whistle. The girl sat up tall and lean, with long legs stretching out from under her red skirt. Joe tried not to stare. He tried to think of Mariah and not notice the girl's perfectly sloping breasts.
"I know her," said Ralph. "She comes to the colored camp council meetings."
"Maybe I should join the colored camp council," said Otis. "I didn't know there were women there."
"Is she the only one?"
"You know her name?"
Ralph shook his head. "Never talked to her. Just seen her around."
"Damn," said Otis. "Colored camp council. What goes on there, anyway?"
"Folks complain about all the things wrong with this place," said Joe, "then write letters about it."
Ralph went to the meetings once a week and talked Joe into coming with him once. About 10 men sat in a circle smoking and talking about all the things they didn't like about Oak Ridge. Joe agreed with what they said. The Hutmans were a disgrace, crime was out of control, and the fact that married colored couples couldn't live together was awful. But he couldn't figure out what these men wanted to do about it. Afterward, he asked Ralph, who said they wanted to change things.
"How?" Joe had asked. "We organize ourselves just like the white folks' unions. We make ourselves heard."
Joe hadn't seen this girl at the meeting, that's for sure.
"Let's ask him to join us," said Otis. "I don't know," said Ralph, suddenly shy.
Joe chuckled.
"Don't look at me, I'm a married man.
If I don't talk to that woman in the next 2 minutes, some other man will."
Otis took a gulp of his Coke and walked over to the table. Joe looked over at Ralph. The man who had been itching for a fight earlier now looked like a nervous boy, his wet clothes still clinging to him. Joe tried to be encouraging.
"They look like real nice girls." "How can you tell if they're nice?"
"Reckon I can, but they're pretty."
They couldn't hear what Otis was saying, but the girl's face was unimpressed. Her friends glared protectively at him. Otis finished, and the girl said something back to him and glanced over at Ralph and Joe.
"What do you think she's saying?" asked Ralph.
"Well, I know better than to guess what a woman got on her mind."
Otis crossed back over to their table, still with a grin on his face. The girl and one of her friends followed him over. Joe figured he should stand as the ladies got near, and Ralph did the same, knocking his knees on the table as he got up.
"This here's Shirley and Sarah," said Otis.
Shirley was the one he was after. She extended her hand toward Ralph. He paused for a moment, then shook it.
"I'm Ralph. Pleased to meet you. I've seen you at the Colored Camp Council." "Yeah, I've gone a couple times to the meetings, when it ain't during my shift."
Sarah smiled at Joe, who nodded to her, trying to be friendly. They all sat back down. Shirley hardly glanced at Otis or Joe. She was focused on Ralph.
"What got you coming to the meetings?"
"Well, it was our foreman, Mr. Brown, who told me about it. He'd seen me reading colored newspapers on my break and asked if I was interested."
Otis tried to break into the conversation.
"What's a lady like yourself doing at them meetings?"
Shirley gave him an icy look.
"Trying to improve working and living conditions for my race."
Otis raised an eyebrow and grinned at Joe, who tried not to look at him. Shirley turned back to Ralph.
"Where are you from?"
"Me and Joe are from Alabama. We came up together for the work."
"Where are you ladies from?" asked Joe.
"I'm from Knoxville," said Sarah in a soft voice.
"Atlanta," said Shirley.
"Well, you ought to be careful in a place like this," warned Otis.
"I've been in worse places," said Shirley.
"Y'all work in construction?" asked Sarah.
The men nodded.
"We work in a laundry."
"What'd you do back in Alabama?" asked Shirley.
"Sharecropping,"
answered Joe.
"What did your father do in Atlanta?"
"I don't know," she said, looking him straight in the eye. "Never met him. I was raised by 2 of my aunts. They were seamstresses."
Otis, either giving up on Shirley or trying to make her jealous, leaned over toward Sarah.
Would you like to dance?
No one else is, the girl said.
Don't matter, said Otis.
He stood and reached out a hand to Sarah. She giggled, and he escorted her to the empty side of the room where they started swaying in time to the music.
You've been friends with Otis long? Asked Shirley.
Ralph shook his head.
He's not so bad.
We just haven't been spending much time around ladies. She didn't reply. They all glanced over to where Otis and Sarah were dancing. Joe looked at Ralph, hoping the boy would ask this lovely girl to dance. Finally, Ralph blurted out, I don't know any dances. For the first time since coming over, Shirley smiled.
I can teach you.
Oh, I don't know.
Sure I can. Do you mind, Joe?
No, of course not. You young people have fun. I'm going to head on home for the night.
Ralph stood slowly and walked Shirley off to the side of the room. He began awkwardly jerking back and forth. Shirley laughed. Ralph looked up at her and began to laugh, too. As Joe watched them, he thought of Mariah at that age, so soft and firm and warm to touch. He got up to go.
A night like that, he worried he'd go crazy in the hutment, listening to the sound of rain pounding on the roof and the hum of mosquitoes circling his head. And now, it was almost winter.
The mosquitoes were gone, and already the hutment was unbearably cold at night. The cold came earlier here than in Alabama, and, of course, the hutment was no better insulated now than it had been a year ago.
Another season come and gone here in Tennessee.
His children growing taller by the day, and him not there to see it. It drove him crazy to think about how they were changing, how he was missing it all. But being a parent meant always being nostalgic for how your children used to be. Joe missed his girls' baby coos when they became toddlers, and then missed their toddler gibberish as they learned to talk. Change was so constant with children that you never had time to catch up. Joe needed to talk to Ralph, he decided. He should be glad the boy had a girlfriend. It was only natural at his age, but he couldn't help but think that Shirley and Otis were turning Ralph against him. It was silly, a childish thing to think. And yet it was true, wasn't it? Ralph had better things to do with his time than pal around with an old man. Joe found Otis's glamour suspicious, but the boy seemed to like it, and he was drawn to an independence in Shirley that Joe didn't understand. It wasn't just the fact that he couldn't work out Ralph's young friends that made Joe feel old these days. His muscles ached more and more. His knees creaked, and at night his lower back pulsed with pain as he tried to sleep. His body was wearing out, and it frightened him. He'd always relied on his strength to get by in life, whether it was in the cotton fields in Alabama or the construction sites here in Tennessee. Joe was lying in bed, still awake, when Ralph showed up at the hutment an hour or so later. He sat up, happy to finally have some company.
You'll have a nice time with Shirley?
Ralph shrugged.
Is she your girlfriend now?
I don't know.
Ralph sat on his bed to take off his boots.
You going for walks together late at night?
Shirley and me got common interests.
That's usually how romance starts.
We're both members of the Colored Camp Council.
You wouldn't understand.
The words stung. Joe was used to Ralph's dissatisfied tone, but it wasn't usually directed at him.
I ain't stupid.
Ralph sighed, as though Joe were indeed very stupid, and it was a struggle to speak to him.
No, of course not. But you're not concerned with our work. I've got my own concerns.
I know. Don't you worry about it.
Joe lay back in his bed, angry now, even less likely to sleep. He tried to forget Ralph and focus on reconstructing his children's small, chubby faces in his mind. He subtracted baby fat, added height and maturity, but it was useless. He didn't know who they were becoming. Chapter 7 Cece had to work Christmas morning, but she didn't mind. June had invited her to dinner at her family's house, and she'd been glad to have the excuse to stay in Oak Ridge. She planned to stay as far away from farms as possible for the rest of her life, and she might as well be doing something useful today rather than wasting time at church or getting fat on June's mother's pie. Anyway, Christmas had never been much to celebrate at Cece's house. If she was lucky, a few hard candies would appear in the bottom of her stocking, and occasionally an orange. A day like any other, with a little extra church. Since she'd left home, Cece hadn't once contacted her family. Occasionally, in her darkest moments, lying in bed, listening to the roller rink, she would think of her poor, pathetic mother. Did she also lie in bed at night, wondering where Cece had gone? Who knew? The woman had fed her and clothed her as best she could, but never seemed to have the time or energy to want anything more to do with her daughter. When her shift was over, Cece went straight to the cafeteria. Normally, she would have gone home first to change and freshen up. You never knew who you might meet in the cafeteria. She had been asked out on 2 dates there. But the town was dead today, and she wanted to eat quickly, by herself. The staff had tried to jolly up the dining room for the holiday. A sun tinsel hung over the door, and they were serving turkey and mashed potatoes. A group of volunteer carolers stopped by as she ate her dinner. Cece smiled politely at the women as they sang Jingle Bells, but really wished they would keep on moving. Midway through the performance, Cece saw her roommate Lisbeth approaching her table. Cece stiffened and glared. Lisbeth didn't usually talk to her. Cece treated her so coolly that she surely couldn't want to be friends. But here the girl was, taking a seat across from her with a wide grin.
Merry Christmas, Cece.
Hi, Lisbeth.
That sure makes you miss home, being here on Christmas.
Cece sawed at a piece of turkey without looking up.
I am happy to be here, doing my part for the war effort.
Lisbeth raised an eyebrow.
Sure, I am too, but I do miss my home on a day like this. I don't miss anything.
Lisbeth took a swig of milk and considered Cece.
You from Nashville, is that right?
Yes.
And you don't miss living in such a big, pretty city? I used to love to visit Nashville when I was little.
Nashville seems big and pretty only if you've never been to New York or Chicago.
Wow. When did you go to New York?
Cece preferred to keep her lies as unspecific as possible.
Before the war. Well, I miss everything. My mama and daddy, my big brothers, even the cows.
Cece was eating fast, hoping to finish before Lisbeth so they didn't have to walk home together. The girl seemed completely oblivious to her antipathy, rambling on about her family back in Lewis County. Cece stared at her plate, refusing to look at her.
You know, they can't even imagine where I live at now. Last week I wrote to Mama and told her about how big the factory is where I work, and, you know, she wrote back.
Cece looked up, a sudden happy thought coming to her.
She asked if it was bigger than Mr. Ingalls's barn.
Lisbeth laughed aloud at the memory.
Poor Mama. The biggest building she could imagine was a barn.
You wrote to your mother, describing the top secret facility where you work?
Lisbeth's face fell.
I just said it was big.
I could report you.
Cece could barely suppress a smile.
Oh, Cece, you wouldn't. You know I ain't meant nothing by it.
The girl was more stupid than Cece had realized.
Move out.
What?
Where am I supposed to go?
I don't care. You must know someone you can move in with.
Lisbeth was starting to cry.
I ain't meant no harm.
Cece stood up.
Move out, or I'll report you.
She turned and walked away without another look back at Lisbeth, letting the smile she'd been holding back spread across her face. She must have looked like a grinning idiot when the tall soldier standing by the door first saw her. He opened the door wide for her.
Merry Christmas.
Cece turned her smile toward him as she walked out the door.
What's your name?
He asked.
Cecilia.
You make a guy homesick on Christmas.
He was now shouting after her. She stopped and turned back.
Why's that?
The soldier gave her a teasing half-smile. He was quite good-looking, she realized, with light brown hair and liquid blue eyes.
You remind me of a girl I used to know.
Cece raised an eyebrow.
You don't know me.
Not yet.
His grin widened.
What do you say? You don't want to spend Christmas all alone, do you?
You think I'm that easy to ask out?
No, but it was worth a shot. Come on, don't tell me you aren't a little homesick, too.
You should ask Lisbeth out, Cece thought. They could go on about missing home together.
home, Cece began. Father would be carving the turkey, and Mother would be playing carols at the piano.
I knew you didn't have a heart of stone. What do you say, Cecilia? I'm a good guy, I promise. Let me buy you a Coke, at least.
I have plans tonight.
Cece turned back toward the boardwalk, away from him.
Oh, can I call you at least?
Without looking back, she said, I'm in West Dormitory. Cece Roberts.
She took a long route home, hoping to give Lisbeth plenty of time to consider her threat. The town was almost quiet, though there was still construction going on somewhere, and she could hear the rumble of engines in the distance. She pushed her hands deep into her coat pockets for warmth. The pockets were satiny smooth inside, woolen and warm outside. She'd bought the coat 2 months ago, the first decent coat she'd ever owned. The thought of that soldier lit her up. You really never did know who you might meet, and she hadn't even done her hair. It was always good to have a new prospect on the horizon, not just in terms of her ultimate goal, but also because it gave her something positive to focus on. She tried to occupy herself with her plans, with the next thing, with the thrill of being chased, the satisfaction of conquest. Otherwise, a thing like Christmas could get you down. By the time Cece got back to the dorm, a note was waiting at the front desk from Private Tom Wolcott. And up in her room, Lisbeth had just finished packing all her belongings into a trunk. Mary's boyfriend, Bill, volunteered to drive her and June home on Christmas. June had wrapped store-bought presents for her parents in store-bought tissue paper. Mary, of course, did the same, but that hardly diminished June's pride. Bill wanted to meet their parents, and June figured he was going to marry her sister soon. Mary spent all her time with him. June had hardly seen her since she arrived in Oak Ridge. He had a job with the Army Corps of Engineers and looked grand in his green wool uniform with shiny brass buttons. He always went out of his way to be polite to June, which she knew was meant to impress her sister. Today, he was acting more relaxed, like the brother he wanted to be. He glanced at her in the rearview mirror.
Hey, June, what's the name of that girl you always hang around with?
Cece. She's my roommate.
Cece, that's right.
He let out a low whistle.
That one is trouble.
Mary gently slapped his arm.
Bill, that's not nice to say. She's June's friend.
Then June should know better than anyone. I've seen some of my boys go after her. She eats them right up and spits them back out.
June didn't really feel like talking about Cece.
She likes to flirt, she said noncommittally.
I'll say. Hard to find a man in my company who hasn't gotten flirted with by her.
Can we change the subject? Asked Mary.
Sure, said Bill, grinning at her. What'd you get me for Christmas?
You'll find out soon enough.
Another gentle arm slap. June was impatient to get home. She watched houses go past, lights on, smoke spiraling from chimneys, and couldn't wait to be in her own parlor across from Mama and Daddy. As they pulled into the hollow, she smiled without even realizing it. The familiar fields and hills were covered in frost. On one side of the road, a small stream flowed at the bottom of a steep wooded hill, while on the other, rolling farmland spread out across a small valley. She knew who owned and lived on each piece of land, and had been in most of the houses at some time or another. This was home. They were almost to their own farm when she noticed a figure in the yard of the Jackson's place. She could only see his side, silhouetted against the morning sun, slumped forward on a pair of crutches. She squinted.
Mary, is that Ollie Jackson?
He turned to look at the passing automobile. In an awful instant, June recognized that it was indeed Ollie, and that he was missing his left leg.
Oh, poor Ollie, said Mary. Bill, stop the car. We should go say hello.
June knew her sister was right, but dreaded getting closer to her former schoolmate. The last time she'd seen Ollie, he'd been a normal kid, playing football with the other boys. He'd also been Ronnie's best friend.
Hello there,
Mary called out. She never seemed afraid of awkward situations. The two girls walked quickly to where Ollie stood. He shouted, Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas,
they both echoed.
It's so good to see you, Ollie, said Mary.
What's left of me, anyway? He said this with a smile,
staring down at the space where his leg should be. June was relieved that he acknowledged it straight away.
How long have you been home? June asked.
Just a week, here on the farm. I've been back stateside for a couple months in a hospital.
I'm so sorry, said June, and indeed she could feel her eyes brim slightly with tears.
Well, at least I'm alive.
I'm sorry for you too, June. We all miss Ronnie something awful.
The tears spilled over, and she felt somewhat relieved, then of course guilty for feeling relieved, knowing that crying at the mention of Ronnie's name was an appropriate response.
He sure did love you, June heard Ollie say.
She wiped her eyes with the sleeve of her coat. It was selfish and stupid for her to be crying when he was the one missing a leg. How ridiculous that he should feel sorry for her.
Thank you,
she whispered.
Your mama must be happy to have you home for Christmas, said Mary in her gentle voice.
Yeah.
He looked over at the four-room house badly in need of paint.
It's good to be home.
It is, said June.
We don't want to keep you from your family on Christmas, said Mary. It was real nice of y'all to stop by.
You take care, Ollie, June said.
It took seeing her father on the porch waving as they drove up to raise June's spirits once more. As soon as Bill stopped the car, June leapt out and ran to the house. Frank enveloped her in his strong arms. By the time June was through the door, her mother had already come out of the kitchen to embrace her, bringing along with her the rich smell of roasting meat.
"How is he?"
she whispered in June's ear, referring, of course, to Bill.
"Nice,"
was all June had time for before the door opened and Mary and her father came in, followed by Bill, who was carrying a Christmas wreath in one hand and playfully slapping her father on the back with the other.
"And this must be Rose,"
Bill said in a loud, hearty voice. June could tell that, despite his bravado, he was scared.
"Pleased to meet you," her mother said as she shook his hand.
"Thank you so much for inviting me into your home." "Of course, any friend of Mary's is welcome here," said Frank. "I brought this as a thank you."
Bill held out the pine and holly wreath to Rose.
"Isn't that lovely? Frank, can you hang it on the door?"
"Sure."
"Come on in and sit down," said Rose. "I'm still working on dinner, but there's coffee for anyone who wants it."
They sat in the living room. Like every year, June could remember, stockings were hung above the fireplace, and her mother had decorated a scraggly pine tree her father had cut down in the woods behind the house. Rose brought in a tray of coffee mugs and passed them around. Frank came back in from hanging up the wreath, and they all sat in a circle, staring at Bill.
"Mary tells us you're in the army," Frank finally said.
"That's right, sir. The Army Corps of Engineers. So I'm serving right here in Tennessee."
"What exactly does the Corps of Engineers do?"
asked Frank. "Engineering projects for the Army, sir. I've been involved in the construction of the Clinton Engineer Works, where your daughters work, since it was first begun."
Mary beamed proudly at him.
"It seems that's been a mighty big project," said Frank. "I'm afraid I can't talk about it. You probably already know from the girls that we aren't allowed to talk about our work." "That's what they said, but I thought maybe they were just trying to get us old folks to stop asking questions."
"It's true, Daddy," said Mary. "Sensors check our mail. We could lose our jobs if we say too much."
"But more important, we could lose the war."
Bill was all seriousness when he said this, and June had to suppress a chuckle. It was like he'd stepped right out of one of the posters at work.
"We saw Ollie Jackson on the way in," said Mary. "I know I should have written to you girls about it," said Rose, "but I just never could figure out how to put it in my letters."
"He seems in good spirits," said June.
"Brave boy,"
said Frank, as though it were too painful to form a complete sentence. The room was silent for a moment, except for footsteps coming down the stairs. Jericho appeared, the same as ever, in his overalls and long beard.
"What's all these folks doing here?"
"It's Mary and June, Jericho, your granddaughters, and this is Mary's friend Bill."
Jericho stared at them all blankly.
"Where's my dogs?"
"In the pen, Jericho. We're keeping them outside today because we have company. You should put on a coat if you're going out."
Frank took a coat down from a hook beside the door. Jericho took it from him silently and went out. After the meal, they exchanged gifts, then sat around the parlor drinking a second round of coffee. June wished she could stay by the fireplace into the evening and sleep in her childhood bed, but Mary was anxious to get back.
"I have the worst headache," she said as they drove out of the hollow.
She let out a little moan of pain. And I'm supposed to sit for the Greeleys tonight.
On Christmas? Asked Bill.
They have a fancy army party to go to.
Why don't you have June cover for you?
June leaned forward at the sound of her name.
Who are the Greeleys?
Mary turned around to face her.
Bill's boss and his wife. They have 3 kids, 4, 7, and 12. They're good kids and real nice folks, and they'll pay you $1 an hour.
All right. The thought of spending the evening alone, or even with Cece, was awfully depressing anyway. The line to get back through the security gate was almost a mile long. Mary held her head with one hand and continued to let out little moans. June thought she was laying it on a bit thick. She rested her own head against the window and watched the line of cars slowly snaking their way down the dusty road. One of the CEW billboards appeared up ahead. Your pen and tongue can be enemy weapons. Watch what you write and say. It showed a cross with a helmet over it, stabbed through with an ink pen.
I'm supposed to be there at 6:30, said Mary. Do you think we'll make it?
Well, there's nothing we can do to get there any faster, said Bill. It's Christmas. I'm sure they'll be understanding.
It was 6:40 when they did finally get to the Greeleys. They lived at the top of the ridge behind the town center. The hillside was covered with trees and Semesto houses and looked almost like a normal neighborhood rather than an army reservation. As Bill turned onto the road up the hill, he asked June,
"You ever been up to Snob Hill before?"
"Snob Hill?"
"That's what folks call this part of town.
That's where all the nicest houses are.
You see, the farther up you go, the less mud there is."
It was true. The Greeleys had a real yard with grass rather than the typical Oak Ridge mud pit. June could see a Christmas tree in the front window of the house.
"All right," said Mary. "I'll introduce you. Don't worry, Mrs. Greeley is nice."
Mary knocked on the door, and June stood beside her, trying to look poised and responsible. Still, it was hard not to gape at the woman who opened the door, wearing the prettiest dress June had ever seen outside of the movies. It was made of a shimmering gold that stretched all the way down to the floor. June could tell that the top was strapless, though Mrs. Greeley's shoulders were covered with a matching gold jacket. She was thin, and the dress exaggerated her tiny waist, cinching in at the middle before flaring out over her hips.
"I'm so sorry I'm late," Mary began.
"Oh, don't be silly. We're running late as usual ourselves." Mrs. Greeley opened the door wide for them to come in.
"This is my sister, June."
June extended her hand, and Mrs. Greeley shook it. June glanced around the immaculate living room. A gilded lamp stood over a deep burgundy sofa, and dark wooden furniture lined the walls.
"Merry Christmas to the both of you," Mrs. Greeley said. "We've just come from our parents' house, and I'm afraid I'm getting a sick headache. Would you mind if June filled in for me tonight? She's very responsible and works here at the CEW as well."
"Well, I don't see why that should be a problem." As she spoke, 2 children came running into the living room.
"Mary!"
they called out. They were immediately followed by a man in uniform.
"Hello, Jason and Lucy. This is my sister June. She's going to play with you tonight."
"Hello," said June.
"I got a dollhouse for Christmas," shouted Lucy.
She didn't particularly seem to care if it was June or Mary who heard her news.
"You get home and get some rest," Mrs. Greeley said to Mary.
"All right. Bye-bye, everyone."
"June, why don't you just come in the bedroom with me while I finish getting ready?"
Mrs. Greeley led her down the hallway and shut the bedroom door behind them. She sat down at a vanity and began applying powder to her face.
"I know it's awful to leave the children like this on Christmas night, but it's almost their bedtime. Anyway, we have to go to the major's party, though between you and me, they are dreadfully boring."
She clipped a pair of large, sparkling earrings to her ears.
"I wouldn't be so frantic getting ready, but the maid had the day off, of course. Anyway, the children have already eaten, so you don't have to worry about that. Don't let them have any more candy, even if they beg. Bedtime is 8, except for Jerry, the oldest. He can stay up till 10.
She applied lipstick, mashed her lips together, and stood to face June.
"How do I look?"
"Amazing."
June meant it. Mrs. Greeley led her back into the living room. The man was waiting for her by the door.
"This is Captain Greeley. This is June."
Mrs. Greeley introduced them quickly as her husband helped her into a long black coat and gave June a little nod.
"We should be back around 11. Good night, children."
"Good night,"
they all called out at once, and with that, the elder Greeleys were gone. June faced the children,
all three blue-eyed, well-dressed, and exceptionally clean.
"Want to see my dollhouse?" asked Lucy. "Want to see my truck?" asked the littlest one.
Jerry rolled his eyes at his younger siblings and announced, "I'm going to read in my room." Lucy and Jerry